Maybe they own this island.
Nobody owns this island. People do not own islands in real life.
Johnny Depp does. He owns an island.
I hate to say it, murmured Chase, but I think he's right on that one. I don't care if he is right, Iman said. Just maybe consider we could be trespassing and you might be pointing a gun at the rightful owner.
Iman's eyes flicked over to Chase, then passed him to Seth, and back.
Then the rightful owner is making my skin crawl, and he would help things a lot by lowering his arm and stepping out onto the beach.
In the corner of Chase's eye, he saw a blur of motion at the tree line, something tall and thin and fluttering and just wrong, blocked out by a quick, blurry flash of white. Wind tugged at his hair even as a hammer strike jolt echoed across the beach, paired with a thunderclap that made his ears throb. Something in the forest let out a wet, gargling roar. Grass rustled and the whirling shape of gray and brown vanished before he had time to focus on it.
What the fuck?
Doug shouted.
You saw it, Iman made it more of a statement than a question. I told you.
Seth snapped at Iman and the two of them fired syllables back and forth at each other. Then he looked at Chase.
Are you all right? Does it hurt?
Does what hurt?
Jesus, man, said Doug. It must have missed you by an inch.
Chase looked around, looked back at the trees.
What missed me?
Seth pointed back toward the water. A long shaft of pale wood, a bit thinner than a broomstick, stuck out of the mud near shore. If the angle had been much steeper, it would have been lying flat on the ground. Then Seth caught his eye again. The crewman reached up and tapped his ear. Chase stared, and then felt the wetness leak into his ear canal. He reached up to touch his own ear. His fingers came back sticky and red. Not soaked in blood, but more than a razor nick, enough to make his breath snag in his chest for a moment. Something small and pink and curved clung to his middle finger. A little piece of meat, barely a half inch long, not even a quarter of that wide. It looked like a sliver of pink chicken. Or his ear started to throb right at the top. A few more drops slid down and muffled the sounds of the wind and ocean.
Oh, shit,
said Chase. He put his hand back to his ear, winced as he brushed the straight, sticky line of the cut.
You were lucky,
Seth told him before throwing another handful of Swahili words at Iman. Chase took a slow step away from the tree line and bumped into Doug. The other man had his phone on a stick steadicam up and pointed at the side of Chase's head.
You okay?
He asked. The question rang of narration, more than concern.
I think so.
The cut felt like a nightmarish sunburn, sizzling away on the top of his ear.
It hurts like hell, but I don't think it's that deep or anything.
Doug panned his steadicam off Chase's head and across the tree line.
What do you think it was?
I didn't get a good look, Chase admitted.
He tipped his head back toward the arguing men.
Iman says it was a man in some sort of camouflaged coat or cloak or something.
Doug shook his head without moving his eyes from the camera's screen.
I don't think it was a man.
The ripple of unease Chase had felt earlier moved under his skin again.
What do you mean? Was it a woman?
No,
he started, then shrugged.
It just didn't move like a man, a person, I mean.
He swung the phone back the other way.
What's that even mean?
It means we're going after him, said Seth, pushing past them.
He stalked toward the trees. Iman called after him in Swahili. Seth reached the patches of grass before the tree line and slowed, just for a moment. He raised his pistol, stepped forward, and then moved between two of the big palms. Chase glanced back at Iman.
What's he doing?
Come on.
The second officer stepped around them, bugged his eyes in frustration, and moved toward the forest. Doug finally looked up from the screen.
What are we doing?
We are going after the person I shot.
Is that a good idea?
Asked Doug. He waved a hand back at the raft and the supply packs.
Shouldn't we be setting up a base camp or stitching up Chase's ear or something?
I don't think I need stitches. Then it's settled,
Iman said.
Everything will be here when we get back.
Chase took a few quick steps and caught up with Iman in the tall grass.
Are you sure about this? If that person...
Seth believes they are either going to need help because they were shot, or they are going to be angry they were shot. Possibly both. Either way, we should find them.
Assuming you hit them, Iman looked back at the beach and the Zodiac.
You are a good man. Tougher than I thought. I think I trust you. You want to stay here, take care of your ear. Keep an eye on Steven Spielberg there. That is fine by me. But we could probably use more eyes in there.
He waved a hand at the trees. Chase looked at the woods, then back over his shoulder. His ear pulsed again, and his skin trembled with the need to keep moving. He looked down at his bloody fingers and flicked away the little sliver of meat.
Hey, Doug.
Yeah?
You want to get all this right for your documentary?
I guess so.
Iman clapped his hands twice.
Time to get moving, then.
7. Chase followed Iman through the trees. Doug lumbered a few yards back, trying to shoot with his Steadicam while they moved through the forest. It made Chase think of the stupid people in found footage movies who kept filming when they were running from monsters or chasing after someone. Of course, they really were chasing after someone. And, to his credit, Doug hadn't stumbled or tripped once. Chase kept catching quick glimpses of Seth 40 or 50 feet ahead. The deckhand still had his pistol out. His head would tilt down to the ground, and then he'd dash ahead another few yards. Sometimes he'd glance up at the trees around them. His ear throbbed. The burning had dulled to an ache, but the occasional gust of wind or strand of hair still set off quick jabs of pain. He probably should have washed it back at the beach, but instead he marched into the jungle. Chase glanced around the forest again. After spending his whole life in cities, his experience as an outdoorsman amounted to a handful of college camping trips. He didn't have a real basis of comparison for marching through knee-high grass with dozens of 4- and 5-story tall palm trees stretching up around him. And yet, something about the forest felt wrong. The grass ranged from dry and yellow to lush and green. A few thick clusters of bamboo reached 10 or 12 feet into the air. Plenty of space divided the trees, although here and there 2 trees grew side by side. As he walked, Chase even saw 3 trees growing in a tight triangle. But they never grew tight enough that blade-like shafts of sunlight couldn't stab down like some heist movie security system. Seth crushed a path through some old palm fronds, paused, then altered his course off to the left. Iman swung to follow. Chase's own shoes crunched in the grass as he pivoted to stay behind Iman. They crashed through the forest for another 5 minutes before Chase coughed into his shoulder.
You still think you hit it?
Iman glanced back.
We could bet on it. You want to lose $20?
He smiled, but it didn't reach his eyes.
Just thinking. If I got shot, I'm not sure I could keep ahead of people running through a forest for this long.
You could if you were scared enough. People can do amazing things when they are scared.
They can also keel over from blood loss, said Chase.
Iman grunted and turned his attention back to Seth's receding form.
I'm just saying, I don't think you hit him.
Maybe I only grazed him,
Iman conceded,
but I still hit him. How is your ear?
Stings a bit, but I think I'll live. barring some deadly jungle infection.
Iman grinned at him. The rustling footsteps behind Chase quickened, and Doug came up alongside them.
"This place is weird," said Doug. "Is it just me, or does it feel fake?"
Chase glanced up at the trees again.
"I was thinking the same thing."
"To be honest," Iman said, "there is something about it I don't like. The trees are wrong."
"It feels like a movie set," declared Doug. "I did the Universal Studios tour a couple of times, and all the places they showed us had this sort of fake feel. It might work for movies, but when you were there in person, you could tell it just wasn't real."
"The trees are wrong," said Iman again.
He stalked forward, glancing up at the treetops.
"They're too even, like an orchard."
"And they're too tall,"
Chase said, the words pushing out through his lips just as the thoughts formed. Iman shot a look at him.
"Too tall," Chase repeated. "This is my third trip through this part of the world. I don't think the trees here, especially the palm trees, they don't grow big like this.
That's a movie thing."
"Yeah," agreed Doug.
"Like I just said."
Iman blinked.
"What?"
Chase took a moment to unspool the chain of thoughts in his head.
"I had a couple days in L.A. back in April. The palm trees were all like this. It's what people expect because it's what they always see on shows that film in Los Angeles."
"But that doesn't really explain it," Doug pointed out. "Palm trees aren't native to L.A. either. They started shipping them in and setting them up back in the 20s as a marketing gimmick."
Iman frowned.
"Eh?"
"They were trying to get people to buy property," explained Doug. "It made the desert look lush and exotic."
"So you believe those trees came from here?"
"No," Chase shook his head. "That's it. These are all Mexican fan palms, if I remember right. And those over there are Australian kings. These trees aren't native to here either."
Iman's hand cut through the air.
"What is your point?"
Chase gestured at a tree.
"My point is, who imports non-native plants to a deserted island in the middle of nowhere?"
"Invasive species are a problem worldwide," huffed Doug.
"It's not invasive if someone's bringing them," Chase said.
"Yeah, it is."
"I mean, it's not accidental. Nobody accidentally brought a few thousand palm trees here and planted them."
Iman slashed a hand through the air again, silencing them, and pointed through the forest after Seth. They followed with quick steps, faster than walking, but not quite running. Up ahead, Chase could see a break in the trees. The usual pattern of growth had failed, creating a small clearing 20 or so feet across where the full brilliance of the sun came down. Seth stood off to one side of the open space waiting for them. He turned his head back and forth, scanning the trees, the canopy, and the floor of the clearing. The pom-pom on his hat flopped back and forth as he did. Despite the sunlight, the grass seemed stunted here, several inches shorter than the overgrowth that spread through the forest. Gray-black stones shoved up through the weeds like little monuments marking off important parts of the clearing. Some of them stood as tall as his hip. They all looked around, and Chase tapped one of the taller rocks.
"What do you think throws up rocks like this?"
he asked.
"Earthquakes? Volcanoes?"
Seth made a low noise, somewhere between a grumble and a growl.
"People," he said.
Chase stepped around the hip-high stone closest to him, looked at it and the shorter stones around it, and then he realized the rectangular stones weren't like monuments. They were monuments. His focus shifted, and he counted up four of the dark tombstones. They stood in a rough line, disguised by the grass and their irregular shapes. The taller stones surrounded them in a loose frame, like fence posts that had never gotten their crossbeams.
"It's a graveyard," said Doug.
He panned his lens across them, then leaned in close to one. He murmured a quiet narration as he did.
"An old one,"
said Iman. He turned to Seth and they fired Swahili sentences back and forth at each other. Chase crouched by the closest stone and pressed the grass down around it. The numbers and letters chiseled into the stone were neat and clean, but the way they sat in relation to each other lacked the subtle finesse of a professional. It reminded him of amateur repair work in electronics, done by people who clearly knew how to solder, but just as clearly had never done this specific work. At the top, Charles Martin had been carved into the stone. Just below it was a simple, roughly carved curlicue leading down to the dates. The first one read February 14, 1894. The one inscribed below it, just along the top of the grass, read January 23, 1905. A Valentine's Day baby, not even in their teens before they died. Not much older than Dina, the last time he'd seen her. He turned to the next marker. This one had no name, just the two dates. They were set higher on this stone. Born December 22nd of 1893, died April 16th of 1904. Another one who died young. What was a children's graveyard doing out on... He squatted lower and pushed aside the grass surrounding the second stone. What the hell? He murmured. Or maybe he didn't murmur it. Iman and Seth stopped there arguing. Doug stumbled over from the far side of the graveyard. What's up? Chase pressed the grass flat against the ground, revealing all of the small slab. A third date stretched across the bottom of the grave marker. August 15th, 1949.
What does that mean?
Asked Iman. Chase straightened up, moved to the next stone down the line. No name, three dates, one over the other. January 8, 1933, March 27, 1944, October 30, 1984. Doug passed him to crouch at the fourth stone and nodded. 1971, 1982, 2011.
Is it a religious thing? Seth asked. A baptism or christening date?
Maybe that's when they were reborn or born again or whatever they call it. Doug turned his camera on the stone in front of him, getting in close to the carving.
The second date is always when they're around 11 years old, said Iman, as if they were following a tradition of some kind.
Some kind of ceremony, said Seth.
He'd stepped away to study the forest. Doug raised his voice, speaking for the camera as much as to them. Three dates on each gravestone, but no names.
Except the first one, Chase said.
Iman raised an eyebrow at him. Chase gestured over at it.
It's got a name on it, Charles Martin, but only two dates.
So, Doug said, someone brought a bunch of trees and dead people to this island and then stuck them all in the ground?
Hey, barked Seth. Show a little respect.
Why? They're all dead, except the trees.
They planned for more,
said Iman. He pointed at the surrounding post stones.
Look how much space is marked off. If they keep the same spacing, someone expected to have another four graves here.
Chase reached up to scratch his jaw just below his ear.
That's not many for a graveyard.
Flecks of blood scraped off as he worked at the skin, wedging themselves beneath his fingernails.
Perhaps it is a private area.
So private it's on an island in the middle of nowhere? Asked Doug.
Maybe they're not graves, suggested Chase. Maybe there's some other kind of memorial for something.
Very convincing, said Iman.
Chase waved at the stones.
I don't know.
Doesn't this feel weird to you?
Four graves in the middle of a transplanted forest on an island that is not on any of our charts.
Iman snorted.
No, this is completely normal to me. It happens two or three times on every voyage.
Seth hissed at them, one sharp breath's worth of sound.
Here, I have the trail again.
Doug whipped around with the camera.
The trail?
The person he shot,
said Seth. He exchanged a look with Iman and left the clearing. Chase straightened up, but kept staring at the stones until the bosun barked at him to get moving.
8.
Seth moved slower now, but to Chase it still amounted to speed walking through the forest. They walked that way for 10 minutes. He looked back toward the graveyard and the beach and wondered how far they'd gone. He couldn't see the clearing anymore, but wasn't sure if it was because of distance or all the bamboo and trees being just thick enough to block his view. How far across the island were they at this point? Maybe they'd only seen the narrow side and it was bigger than he first thought. Doug glanced back, too.
Something on your mind?
Thinking about the graveyard,
said Chase.
What about it?
Remember what Eamon said about it being a private area? That's been nagging at me. I don't think he's right.
Really? Why?
The dates. They cover over 100 years, but they all barely overlap.
So?
Well, if it was a family's private lot, wouldn't you expect more people the same age? Mothers and fathers, that sort of thing?
My mom died when I was 7, said Doug. She wasn't even 30. Now my dad's almost 60.
But you'd still see a bigger overlap. These are all like one parent, one child.
You a dad?
Chase shot a look at the other man. He'd talked to Doug about his divorce at least twice over the past 2 weeks.
Yeah. Figured.
You're a family man, so you assume it's all a family. He smiled.
I noticed the little details.
Yeah, regular Sherlock Holmes. There's something else odd about them, about the middle set of numbers, but I can't put my finger on it.
Do you need to see them again?
Doug raised his camera setup a few inches.
I don't like showing raw footage, but if you think it'd help.
Chase reached up and tapped his skull just above his slashed ear.
Got it all in here for now.
You sure? It's just dates. I'm good with numbers. Helped a lot with my old job.
Right. You were an electrician, right?
More or less, yeah.
Doug smiled again.
See, like I told you, good with details.
Iman glanced back at them and slashed a hand through the air. Doug frowned at being silenced, but altered his pace to drift a few yards from Chase, as if he thought they needed to be separated to stop talking. Seth slowed to a halt, his pistol straight out in front of him, targeting a patch of mossy stones a dozen yards away, backed by a thick wall of bamboo. He took a few cautious steps forward, then a few more. Chase crept forward to stand by Iman. The bosun had slid his own pistol free but kept it low, right by his thigh. Doug wandered back over to join them, his steady cam rig up and running. Iman reached across Chase's chest and put his free hand over the camera's lens.
Shut it off.
Hey,
Doug started.
Shut it off now. Do not make me take it away from you.
But I...
We do not know what we will find. We will decide afterward if you can record it.
Doug glanced at Chase, then back to Iman, and muttered something tinged with resignation. He tapped the phone's screen and it flickered back to desktop mode. His arm swung down and the steadicam pole hung at his side. Seth had cut the distance between him and the stones by half.
I see you, he called out. Do not try anything. We do not want to hurt you.
Maybe we shouldn't have shot at him then, murmured Doug.
Seth took another step forward, then another. His pistol dropped as he moved, staying aimed at the stones. Iman moved forward a few steps as well. Chase followed, and Doug moved slowly behind them. Seth reached a foot forward and tapped a stone that could have been a half-buried football. A few seconds later, he towed it in the side, not hard enough to be a kick. The stone rocked, as did another stone next to it, and the blanket of moss shifted across them. Chase abruptly had the moment of seeing through an optical illusion, of his awareness shifting, The collection of stones and moss and other shapes became the long figure of a man, sprawled beneath a leathery cloak of random browns spotted with green. Even knowing the person was there, Chase had trouble getting his eyes to focus. He'd shift his attention and the camouflage would immediately reestablish itself. Seth shuffled forward and prodded the figure again, somewhere near the hip. Then he took a quick step and slapped the top of his boot into it. Nothing from the shape under the cloak. He gave it another kick. Still nothing. Iman and Seth traded a few silent gestures and nods. Iman's pistol came up, pointed at the form's indistinct, hooded head. Chase tensed as Seth crouched low, keeping his pistol on the prone figure, while his other hand reached for the cloak's ragged hem. He threw the cloak open, stepping back as he did. The mud-caked figure beneath still didn't move. The palms rustled above them, and some of the lower leaves as well. It struck Chase how quiet the forest had become. The sound of wind, but no chirping birds. No buzzing insects. Just like on the beach. From where he stood, Chase couldn't make out many details of the body. The cloak had flopped back down, covering one side of the figure again. It was tall, skinny. Hard to be sure, but it seemed to be masculine. Bare-chested and barefoot. Every inch of skin he could see had been painted in what looked like wet, gray clay. He'd seen photos of old college friends who'd ended up smeared like that after doing mud runs, but he rarely saw anyone covered so completely. Seth stared at the figure for close to a minute.
"He's not breathing," he finally said.
"You killed him," Doug said to Iman.
"I didn't want to, but he made me worried for our safety."
Iman holstered his pistol.
"What do you Americans call it? Stand my ground rules?"
"That's not what that means."
"How'd you even see him?" interrupted Chase, stepping forward. "That cloak pretty much made him invisible." Seth tapped his temple right by his eye.
"Color blind. I've always been good at seeing through camouflage."
Iman said a few words in Swahili. Seth replied, and a new, calmer conversation began. Chase moved closer to the body. He'd found a few dead people right after the hurricane, and seen two or three more since he started touring the world. They'd brought sadness and denial, shock and disgust. This one just made him feel uneasy. It had a sense of wrongness he couldn't put a name to. He remembered another famous optical illusion, one he'd seen a few times. The tuning fork, with two square posts by the handle that somehow became three round tines at the end. Whenever he saw it, he'd lose a moment looking back and forth, trying to figure out the point where his brain's interpretation of the image shifted. That's what looking at the body felt like, even though it had been exposed. His brain couldn't decide where it changed and became something unnatural, even though he was sure it did. The dead man's face was still hidden by the loose hood of his rough leather cloak, barely leather, closer to hides and skin, cured by age and exposure more than effort. Part of his lower body was still covered by a sheath of the same, almost leather. Depending on just how it hung when the man was standing, the garment could have been a loincloth or a skirt. A ragged band wrapped around his wrist, tied off with some cords of the same material. It was too wide to be a bracelet, not wide enough to offer any sort of protection. A bloody bullet hole marred the muddy skin a few inches above the waistband of the skirt thing just below the ribs. The blood looked like oil in the dappled light of the forest. Two thick lines of it ran down into the dirt. Chase was close enough that, if he wanted, he could kick it just like Seth had. Instead, he crouched and looked at the two exposed feet and the long stretch of calf. What he'd mistaken for paint had to be some kind of body makeup. The wet gray was so smooth over the skin, with no clumps or streaks or bare patches. And the feet. Not much wider than his, but 3 or 4 inches longer, easily. Each toe had thick, curling nails wrapping down over the front to a jagged edge along the thick, dirty calluses. They were like wide cat claws, cracked and broken after being walked on for years. Chase paused, rewound his thoughts, and looked at the bottom of the foot again. The toes, ball, sole, heel, all of them were painted with the same glossy gray pigment, an impossibly smooth, even coat, with no streaks or smears. "Fellas," Iman and Seth's conversation ended.
"What is it?"
"He has gray skin," Seth snorted a humorless chuckle.
"It's just mud or clay."
"No, it's not," Chase pointed at the colors along the bottom of the foot. "Wouldn't some of it have rubbed off running through the forest?" They all moved closer. Seth leaned in next to Chase and stretched out a finger. He ran it down the center of the man's foot. Just a quick tickle. No streaks. No exposed skin. Seth held the finger up and examined it, looking for any smudge of pigment that had carried over.
"His skin feels funny."
"In what way funny?" said Iman.
"Like I'm touching the skin of an eel, not human skin."
Seth stepped past Chase, across the body, getting closer to the head and shoulders. He took the hem of the hood between his finger and thumb and tugged it back away from the man's face. Chase reeled and paused for a heartbeat, convinced all of this had to be a hoax, a trick the crewmen were playing, and then stumbled back again. He slipped, fell on his ass, and scooted backwards through the grass.
"Jesus Christ!"
Seth muttered something under his breath.
"What in God's name is that?" murmured Iman.
Doug raised his steadicam.
"What is he?"
Chase rolled forward onto his knees, then crawled back to the body. Teeth. The man, the thing, had too many teeth. Dozens and dozens of long, needle-like teeth jutting up from an oversized jaw. Its mouth was filled with miniature tusks stretching up around the flat slits of its nose.
"That's not normal," Doug said.
"No, it is not," agreed Iman.
Chase examined the face, tried to look at anything that wasn't teeth. The lack of nose gave it a flat face, like the evil wizard in the Harry Potter movies. He whose name Chase could never remember. It had stringy sideburns and a deep, greasy widow's peak. Its ears were withered things, baby ears on an adult skull. The eyelid farthest from him swelled out, and he could see an equally swollen, round eye peeking out beneath it. It reminded him of the animation in Japanese cartoons Dina always watched, or those big eels that lived in coral reefs. 2 bumps stretched up through the thin flesh of the other eyelid. Chase tried to think of anything that could make the weird ripple, but didn't like any of the answers he came up with. He set his fingers just below the hairless brow and pushed the skin up. The eyelid slid with it, exposing a dull, elongated iris, and then a second iris. He yanked his fingers back.
"What's wrong?" asked Doug.
"It's got 2 eyes.
"So?"
"It's got 2 eyes there," he said, jabbing a finger toward the closed eyelid, "in the same eye socket."
Seth reached down like Chase had and pulled the lid open again. The 2 eyeballs pressed together in the oversized socket. Iman shuddered. Doug leaned in with his camera.
"Is that,"
he said, his narration voice faltering,
"that thing can't be real?"
It's real, said Chase.
Seth let the eyelid drop and moved his hands down the gray, flat face. He hooked a finger against the creature's thin upper lip and pulled it up toward the nostrils.
Look at all those teeth, he murmured.
From where he crouched, Chase could see the blue-gray gums and a dozen tiny shreds of flesh lodged at the base of the needle-like teeth.
This is the part of the movie where it bites your hand off, murmured Iman.
Seth glared at him.
Shut up.
Just like in The Thing, yes? The original one, not the remake.
Actually, said Doug, the Carpenter one was a remake too. Howard Hawks made the original back in...
You shut up too, said Seth.
Chase let his gaze run down the body. The chest pushed forward high in the center. He could see the shape of its ribs through the gray flesh. He followed the gaunt arm down to a hand with long fingers, just long enough to be creepy, not so as long as to seem monstrous. Each one ended in a fingernail that had grown into a chipped, ragged chisel. He reached for the creature's bunched-up cloak still draped over one side of its body. Seth locked eyes with him and nodded. Chase pinched the ragged edge and pulled it back. His fingers trembled as a shudder ran through his arm, and the leather hem slipped away from him. His stomach churned with denial, but he couldn't keep from leaning in closer. None of them said anything for a few moments as the wind blew through the treetops.
No way, murmured Doug, breaking the quiet.
Under the creature's skin, muscles spread in a wide fan out from the peaked breastbone. Its exposed shoulder bordered on a hunch, sitting almost as high as its chin. The right arm sat high as well, and just below it, another fully formed right arm stretched out from the ribs, this one a hair lower on the torso than an arm would sit. Seth's fingers flexed.
What the fuck is this thing?
It's some kind of mutant, said Doug. He swung his camera rig around, getting the bizarre double shoulder from a different angle. Maybe some kind of evolutionary throwback?
Yeah, from back in prehistory, Chase agreed, when we all had extra eyes and arms.
I'm just blue skying here, man. We won't know for sure until scientists get hold of it.
Wait, said Iman, holding up his hand.
They grew quiet and he curled his fingers down, pointing at a dark spot further down the thing's side.
What is that?
Seth leaned in, turned his gaze to the creature's stomach and scowled.
It's another bullet wound.
Oh, said Chase. That's not good.
No, it is not,
Iman said, setting his hand down on his holstered pistol. Seth straightened up and drew his own weapon. Doug looked up.
What's the problem?
A man only fired one round, said Seth, shaking his head. This isn't the one he shot.
Somebody else killed this one, said Chase.
Doug's eyes went wide. Seth nodded.
And the one he shot is still out there.
9. Murdoch stood on deck as the Liza Dane hummed through the waves toward the island's west coast. Even with his sunglasses on, he squinted at the wind and sunlight hitting his face. After almost 2 solid days inside the Todd Wings chartered jet, though, being outside on the deck felt wonderful. Blissful, even. It had been a long trip. Turned out a private jet was just like a bus, less enjoyable the more people were on board. The experience he'd expected from movies and books didn't pan out once you packed in 12 family members and the 5-person crew and set aside the private cabin in the back for the specialist. He'd run into some of the family members Anne had chosen for the trip before. Daniel Todwing could pass for a mainstream human and had run the L.A. Marathon twice, as he loved to bring up. Hannah, like Murdoch himself, could pass, as long as her eyes were hidden. He'd never actually spoken to Phoebe, the dark-haired Amazon with the just-too-wide mouth, but her sheer size made her pretty unforgettable. And then there was Barnabas. The man looked like death. Literally. The change had left him with dark, round eyes under a hairless brow, and his nose had been reduced to just two long slits in his face. He'd spent most of the trip wearing dark glasses and a dust mask, hiding his face under the pretense of being a germaphobe. Murdoch had found himself paired up with Abraham Todwing, a teeth-grindingly annoying man, for the entire multi-stage flight to Madagascar. He'd often tried to avoid Abe back in L.A. because the man would not shut up. It didn't help that 4 hours into the flight, Murdoch had let something slip. He wasn't even sure what, and Abe had realized Murdoch had known Anne since childhood. He hadn't spilled the intimacy of their relationship, but whatever he said had been enough to spark a nonstop barrage of questions and speculations between the constant invitations to pass the time with cards or dice or some giant robot game Abe had on his tablet. The two of them had sat in the back of the plane together and babysat the specialist. They took turns getting her food, guiding her to the jet's small restroom, and making sure she was as comfortable as possible. Most of the last bit had amounted to helping her back onto the bed after a vigorous bout of thrashing. Being in the back had served another purpose as well. Abe, as the elders liked to say, had received greater gifts than most when the change came on him. His eyes were even larger than Murdoch's. The tint of his skin would convince anyone not in the family that he was deathly ill. And his hands. Murdoch came from a more conservative branch of the family, one that embraced the most severe of changes, even if it meant hiding a cousin from the outside world. That said, the last time he'd seen hands like Abe's had been during a classic monster marathon. Aside from a lack of scales, they were dead ringers for the creature from the Black Lagoon's webbed talons. No surprise, the man was a zealot. What else could he be? And of course, through all of this, they also had to make sure the specialist wasn't seen at all by any of the jet's crew members. The flight crew had been paid a great deal of money to keep their mouths shut and ask no questions about some of the disfigurements they might glimpse during the trip. But still, seeing the family's honored guest would almost definitely make someone freak out. At the least, it would make them more willing to place a quick radio call or talk to airport security during one of the refueling stops, which would not end well for anyone. Especially the crew members. So, Murdoch, who'd never been on a plane in his life, for obvious reasons, flew a little over 11,000 miles and had only been able to look out the windows twice at night. But now, the past 2 days on the yacht had been amazing. Murdoch squinted against the wind and sun at the approaching island. Anne had showed him the calculations and the photos they'd coaxed out of Google Earth, but he hadn't really believed they'd find anything out here. It had turned out to be another waste of time and effort based on old scribblings and vague prophecies, like all the family's little crusades. The island wasn't enough to restore his faith, but it did bring a faint smile to his face. Then again, maybe it was just being out in broad daylight without sunglasses or his hands stuck deep in his pockets like a pervert. All the members of the family walked around the yacht without masks or heavy glasses or any of the other elements that had been part of their lives for so many years. The whole crusade might be a flop on the church side, but he could see how much it was lifting everyone's spirits. Abe grinned like an idiot. Rachel had stripped down to a bikini top to bask in the sun. Barnabas had almost smiled. As they got closer to the island, two other family members joined Murdoch at the front of the yacht. Claudia, a younger woman who had eyes like his own and sharp teeth, but was otherwise a stranger, and a skinny man Murdoch had met and almost forgotten, one of the local family members crewing the Liza Dane. Matthew or Matthias, all he could remember was offhandedly calling the man Matt and getting glared at. Matthew Matthias wrapped his hands around the yacht's chrome railing, showing off some claw-like fingernails in the process.
"At last," he said. "All these decades and we found it. It's finally going to happen."
Claudia nodded.
"The great ones have truly blessed us, to let us live in this time and to be the tools of their release in this world."
A wave exploded into spray as the yacht plowed through it. Murdoch blinked the salt water from his eyes. When he opened them wide again, he found the two family members staring at him. A few seconds ticked by.
"Yeah," he said. "It's great. Lucky us."
Claudia raised an eyebrow. Matthew Matthias glared.
"Why are you here again?"
Murdoch tried to stand a little taller as the ship heaved through the waves.
"Because she trusts me."
It was enough for Claudia, who turned her eyes back toward the island. Less than a mile away now. Matthew Matthias held his gaze for another few moments. Murdoch could almost hear the man counting to 10, determined not to look weak or foolish before he swung his head back to the approaching beach. Murdoch could pick out dozens of tall palms, just like the ones in Los Angeles, and a few of them reached high above the top edge of the forest. The beach was a wide swath of white sand between the green of plants and blue of the ocean, some of it pushing out to form a shallow cove. With the clear, sunny sky, it could have been a picture from some sort of fantasy vacation postcard. Not at all the kind of place you'd expect to go to end the world. Anne stepped out onto the deck. She tied her hair back into a braid that went past the waist of her jeans. An entourage of family members trailed behind her. Daniel, Hannah, a black-eyed man whose name Murdoch had never learned, and Barnabas. All four of them wore backpacks. Daniel and Barnabas also had rifles. Anne glanced at the people on deck and her eyes lingered for a moment on Murdoch.
"We are pretty much ready to disembark as soon as we anchor," she told them. "Claudia, will you join us in the first wave over?" "Thank you, Minister." "Go grab some gear."
Anne looked at Murdoch.
"The specialist can keep resting for now. We'll need her soon enough, but until then, why don't you join us too?"
A few sets of eyes settled on him. He cleared his throat and echoed Claudia's, "Thank you, Minister." Anne's mouth formed an ever so faint smile, just for a moment. The yacht pushed through a few more waves and its engine relaxed. Murdoch could see water crashing against big chunks of volcanic rock stretching up out of the water, the outer edge of the cove. The yacht slid between them, and the water calmed a bit on the other side. It drifted a little farther, and he guessed the shore to be 40 or 50 yards away. The captain, another local family member named Solomon, shouted something in French to Matthew Matthias. Chains rattled and echoed across the deck. The yacht went forward a bit more and then slowed as if the water had thickened around it. Murdoch swayed, watched everyone else sway with him, and the Liza Dane was at rest. The yacht was just big enough to carry a small boat of its own. A little thing, not much bigger than a rowboat, but it could hold four or five people and had an outboard motor about the size of a gallon of milk. The word "alert" was printed in flowing script on its side, but Murdoch wasn't sure if it was a brand name or the boat's name. How big did boats have to be to get a name? As they lowered the "alert" into the water, Anne touched his arm.
"Murdoch, you're with me."
She tossed her pack into the small boat, smiled, and kicked off the deck, knifing down toward the water. She vanished beneath the surface with barely a ripple and reappeared a few moments later, a dozen yards closer to shore. Murdoch tucked his sunglasses inside his shirt and dove between the rails. It was like diving into a bright bath. He flailed beneath the surface for a few heartbeats, baffled at how the ocean suddenly seemed so alien to him. He looked at the bubbles around him, the webbing on his hands, the trembling sky up above. He'd never swum during the day before. A few broad strokes sent him racing through the cove. A few more caught him up with Anne, and he saw the floor of the cove rise up toward him. He let his feet drift down and waded in to the beach. Anne sloshed up onto shore a few feet ahead of him. She squeezed some water from her braid, then grabbed the bottom of her shirt and wrung it out as well. She glanced back as he walked out of the low waves.
Well?
Well, what?
We haven't had a chance to talk since we left L.A. What do you think?
He looked around at the beach, up at the line of trees, back at the volcanic rocks. It's beautiful. It's the kind of place I figured we'd live back when we were planning to run off together. She gave him a sharp look.
I thought our plans had always been to find somewhere in New England or Canada.
Yeah, I guess I wasn't that smart as a kid. Anne laughed.
No, you weren't. But we're here now. That's what matters.
Murdoch bit his lip. He walked a few feet along the beach, then a few more up toward the trees. Water squished out of his shoes with each step, and the sand wrapped them in a layer of mud. The island was quiet. Not silent, but quiet. He could hear the small waves as they popped and bubbled up onto shore, the wind rustling back and forth through the tall trees, the approaching motor of the small boat, and nothing else. No birds or animal sounds, no hum or click of insects. Had he and Anne startled them all to silence when they splashed up out of the water? He turned to her.
So, any idea where this thing is?
She squeezed some more water out of her shirt, shook it off her hands.
It's here, on the island.
It's kind of a big place.
Not that big. 3.5, maybe 4 square miles.
And we don't actually know what we're looking for.
Which is why we brought the specialist, Anne said, tipping her head back toward the ship.
Her gaze settled on him. A little flirty, but not as warm as it had been the other day.
You're not suddenly doubting again, are you?
Murdoch pulled his mouth into a smile.
No, of course not. I want you to be right about all this. I want you to succeed.
Us to succeed,
she corrected him. A little warmth flowed back into her eyes.
This is about all of us, not just me, the whole family.
He bit his tongue and forced another smile. The small boat buzzed up and a handful of family members spilled out. Hannah stayed in the alert by the engine, blinking her oil-black eyes in the sunlight. Once everyone else was out with all their gear, Barnabas and Claudia pushed the small boat back into the water. Hannah twisted a control and the alert withdrew from the beach. It made a tight circle, kicking up ripples across the cove, and headed back toward the Liza Dane.
All right, everyone,
Anne said, raising her voice.
Remember why we're here. Spread out. Make sure the beach is secure and look for any sort of landmark, something that would have been left behind, a trail, marks on trees, arrangements of stones. Maybe we'll get lucky and they'll have left a big painted sign for us.
Daniel and Claudia laughed. The man whose name Murdoch couldn't remember blinked his bulging round eyes as he chuckled politely. Barnabas stared at Anne, but didn't react. Way too full of himself. He would have fit in well with the Olmsteads. Back when they weren't all dead. Or in prison. Barnabas swung his rifle off his shoulder and into his arms. He walked south along the coastline, and the no-name man wandered a few yards behind him. Daniel and Claudia headed down the beach, walking so close their shoulders almost brushed. Murdoch looked at Anne.
I'll be fine, she told him. I'm alone on a beach. What could happen?
That, he said, is just asking for something to happen. She smiled.
Go look in the woods. Once the next group gets ferried over, you and Abraham can help our guest over here.
Murdoch hadn't made it three steps before a shrieking whistle echoed across the beach.
"Here!"
shouted Barnabas from a little over 100 feet away. He held the rifle up high above his head, as if anyone could miss him, on the beach. His other hand pointed at a mass of seaweed the tide had pushed up onto the sand. The no-name man was crouching down to study the pile. Murdoch and Anne exchanged a glance and headed down the beach. They'd cut the distance to Barnabas in half before Anne sped up, taking long strides.
"What is it?"
The big man lowered his rifle and stepped toward the mound of seaweed.
"Gideon spotted it," he said. "It's still fresh."
Anne stepped forward while Murdoch hung back, making a mental note of Gideon's name. She reached into the mass of seaweed, grabbed a broad piece of kelp, and lifted it out of the way. A collection of sun-grayed tree limbs sat underneath, giving the pile most of its bulk. And then she moved the covering cloak a little more, and Murdoch realized he was looking at a body. 10.
"I don't think we should jump to any conclusions," said Doug. He kept filming as he spoke, panning the camera across the body and back up to their faces. "Maybe this is the one Iman shot at. Maybe it isn't. Maybe there's someone else here. Maybe there's not."
"It isn't the one he shot," said Chase.
He straightened up from the dead creature. The wind had picked up and a chill crawled across his arms. A nearby cluster of bamboo rocked back and forth. The front edge of the storm was pushing closer.
"But how can we know that?" asked Doug.
"Because he only fired one shot," said Seth, speaking slowly. "And this one was shot twice, with a rifle, I think."
"Or maybe a pistol at close range,"
Chase offered. Seth considered it and conceded with a grunt.
"But how can we be sure?" Doug repeated.
Iman glared at him.
"Do you turn into a complete idiot when that thing is turned on?"
"I'm just trying to document it all. You realize what this is, right?"
Chase stared at him.
"If it's not a mutant or an evolutionary throwback, it means we've discovered a new species. This is major stuff, and I'm documenting all of it. We're going to be famous."
Seth furrowed his brow. Iman rolled his eyes.
"You are an idiot."
"I'm telling you, it's some kind of cryptid like Bigfoot or the Chupacabra. This is huge."
Chase turned away from Doug.
"So," he asked Iman, "what are you thinking?"
"I am thinking animals do not wear clothes," the bosun replied. "I think there is at least one more thing like this out here, possibly wounded and angry. And I think there is someone else out here with a rifle who might mistake us for that angry thing."
"Or it could be weeks old," said Doug. "Who knows when this thing was killed?"
"It's still fresh," said Seth. "The body is not even a bit rotten. It's not even cold."
"Maybe it doesn't rot," said Doug.
"Everything rots," Iman said.
Chase looked around at the trees.
"We didn't hear a shot. So it had to have happened at least, what, an hour and a half ago?"
"The wind might have taken the sound of the shot."
Seth gestured up at the swaying trees.
"It could have happened just as we were landing on the beach, possibly even as we were running through the forest."
As if on cue, a stiff breeze rattled the tall bamboo behind the rocks. It sent a series of dry, rustling clicks echoing down from the treetops. The sounds echoed for a moment, and then the wind carried them away.
"Okay," said Iman, "back to the beach. We cannot stay here. Not on this island if there are more of these things."
Chase let his gaze drop from the bobbing treetops.
"So where are we going?"
"Back to Makara."
"Back to the ship?" asked Doug. "The ship we were evacuated off?"
Seth frowned but said nothing. Iman gestured back more or less the way they'd come.
"We can probably still make it back before the storm hits,"
Chase shook his head.
You can't be serious. The storm's already here.
We cannot stay here,
Iman repeated. Doug waved an arm at the body. What about this?
What about it? It's a scientific discovery.
Seth spat at the ground near the body.
Then science can come carry it back to the beach.
Another gust of wind made the palm trees clatter above them. Doug looked at Iman, then at Chase.
You get it, right? We can't just leave this thing here.
Gotta be honest, Chase said. I'm thinking more about us being out on the open ocean when the storm hits.
If you have a better idea, I would like to hear it.
Iman set his fists on his hips, and for a moment the only image in Chase's head was reading Peter Pan to Dina when she was little. He forced himself not to smile. Then a sound made him look up. The wind had faded again, but clicks and snaps still echoed down from the treetops. Not the thin, wooden sound of palm fronds, though. These sounds had a softer edge to them. Another memory fragment burst up in his mind. Dina coming home from school and talking about the Kung, an African tribe who clicked their tongues as part of their language. Little popping clicks had filled their home for days. So much like the clicks drifting down from the treetops. Seth was looking up too, and Iman.
Do you hear that too?
Is that birds? Asked Doug. A new sound joined the clicks, or grew out of them. A low, rattling stutter, almost a purr. Both sounds had a wet edge to them, like someone speaking with a phlegmy throat.
It's not birds, Chase said.
A leopard,
suggested Seth. His pistol was in his hand again and held up by his shoulder. The sounds echoed around them, too many sounds for one throat. Chase tried to isolate them, to figure out how many sources there were, but the best he could manage was more than two.
We will head back to the beach now,
said Iman, drawing his own pistol.
That sounds great, agreed Chase.
Doug pointed at the body with his free hand.
But what about the...
Seth grabbed Doug's sleeve and dragged him into motion. Iman took the lead, moving with firm, decisive steps. Chase kept looking between the trees and the ground as they retreated through the forest. He glanced back and saw Seth give Doug another shove. The clicking sounds faded a bit, then grew close again. They came from the left, then behind, then from the right, and behind again. Once a wooden scrape echoed down, the actual sound of something brushing against the thick palm fronds, but whatever it was, vanished before Chase could pinpoint the source of the sound. He took a quick step forward.
Are we running?
He asked quietly.
Not if we do not have to,
said Iman.
Many animals give chase if you run away from them.
Now they're animals?
I don't know what it is up there. I don't know what that dead thing was. I just know I will feel better when we are away from this place.
Can't argue with that. They can't be too big, said Doug. He kept glancing up at the trees. If they were big, they couldn't hide in palm trees.
One of them hid right in front of us, Chase pointed out.
Doug took in a breath to answer, looked up again, and kept quiet. They traipsed through tall grass, stepped over fallen palm fronds, weaved between clumps of black rock. The chittering noises kept pace with them for a few more minutes. Then the rustle of trees in the wind rose up and replaced them. Doug stopped and looked up.
Are they gone?
Seth shoved him.
Keep moving.
I think they gave up.
Iman slowed for a moment. He looked to his left and right, then over his shoulder to Seth. The two exchanged a few quick words. Chase slowed his pace.
What? This is not the route we came, said Seth. We should be heading east-northeast.
Doug flapped his hands in exasperation.
Why didn't you say something sooner?
I was watching behind us, not ahead.
Iman kept walking, leading them forward, but his pace faltered again. He looked over his shoulder, then forward again.
Which way is the sun?
They glanced up at the treetops as they hiked through the forest. Chase tried to find a strong shadow, but clouds had made the brightest spots dim and hazy at best. He slowed down for a better look, and Seth gave him a little shove.
It's okay, said Doug. I've got a compass.
He slid a green metal disc from his pocket and flipped it open.
This is embarrassing,
muttered Seth.
Getting lost in the woods? Asked Chase. Or having Doug come to the rescue?
Both.
Doug held the compass in his palm. He swung it side to side and frowned.
It's not working, he said after a moment. The needle won't point at anything. It just keeps swinging around.
Give it here, said Seth, stepping forward to snatch the compass away.
Hey!
Don't you even know how to use this?
He lifted it to chest height, and Chase could see the needle swinging around from the movement. It whirled to the left, a half circle back to the right, then spun around three times. The needle slowed for a moment, then started spinning like a propeller again.
Your compass is broken.
It's not broken, I just bought it.
Then you bought a broken compass.
Seth flicked his wrist and tossed the little disc off into the tall grass.
Hey!
Doug loped after the compass, crouching down to push stalks of grass aside.
Everybody calm down,
said Iman. He pointed at some of the more distinct shadows, then off past Chase's right shoulder.
The sun is that way, more or less, so east is that way, more or less. It will get us to the beach. We will be fine from there.
Chase nodded.
Smart man. Hey, check this out.
Doug pulled something from the undergrowth.
It's a block.
Chase tried to get a better look at it.
Block of what? A wooden block, you know, like blocks? Kids' toys.
He tossed it to Chase. It was maybe 2 inches across. The uneven edges looked hand-shaped, not machined. Flakes of faded paint hung to the different sides. Chase held the block at arm's length and turned it until he saw shapes in the paint remnants.
I think it's got letters on it.
Of course it does, said Doug.
It's a block.
No, I mean, I think they're letters, I'm not sure.
He flipped the wooden cube around one side at a time.
That's a T, and that's an X, but this looks like a pitchfork?
Iman leaned in over his shoulder.
Is it an E? A curvy one?
If it is, it's a different style from the other letters.
He turned the block again, angling it until his eye caught a pattern in the flecks of colored paint.
And that's a weird U.
Maybe a C.
No, it's a...
Chase turned the block upside down and pointed at two faded lines at each end of the curve.
It's an ohm.
A what?
An electronic measurement, an omega.
He flipped the block back and forth.
I think these are all Greek letters. It's all Greek to me,
said Doug, laughing at his own joke.
No, I mean actual Greek, the Greek language.
It was not a Greek name back on the tombstone, was it?
Asked Iman.
Nope. Somebody was teaching him Greek, though. Learning the classics, I guess.
Or there were other kids here, Doug pointed out. Chase tossed the block back to Doug.
Any others? Didn't see any.
We should get moving,
said Seth. They headed off on their new course through the trees. Iman moved at a refreshed pace, looking ahead more than up. Chase glanced back and saw Doug fumbling to put his camera array back in his pack while Seth kept pushing him to move faster. Then he looked ahead again, just in time to see Iman take 3 steps and vanish. Even with just 3 seconds of hindsight, Chase saw the mistake. How many childhood cartoons and B-movies had warned him of this exact scenario? The fallen palm fronds all lying in a rough circle, completely covering the ground. Or the lack of ground, in this case. Iman's howl filled the air. It broke off. They heard him suck in a wet breath, and he screamed again. The scream broke into bubbling sobs.
Chase ran forward to the edge of the pit. Seth reached it at the same time. They both froze. Iman had fallen, face down, into the spike trap, and the 3-foot bamboo shafts held him up above the dirt floor. A slick, red one pierced his left forearm, another his right thigh just above the knee. One, coated with darker blood, stretched up through the back of his hockey shirt just above his waist, but the nylon fabric also tented up close to his shoulder on the other side. Another stake had caught the side of his head and ripped through his cheek, twisting his head around and leaving a bloody gash along his jawline.
"Oh, fuck,"
said Chase. Iman let out another low moan. It trailed off into a cough that sprayed blood out over a nearby stake. His free hand flailed at the air as the fingers on his impaled arm twitched open and closed. Heavy drops of blood fell like rain on the floor of the pit. His old hurricane reflexes kicked in, and Chase stepped forward, digging his heels into the side of the hole. He slid down 4, 5, 6 feet, and stopped himself by grabbing one of the stakes. His feet crunched on the fallen leaves and palm fronds. He pushed through the forest of bamboo spikes, each one brushing his ribs, until he was near Iman's bloody head. "Hang on," he said. "We'll get you out."
"Easy, boss,"
said Seth. He stood across from Chase, looking at his shipmate with wild, panicked eyes.
"We've got you."
Iman wailed again, a mindless sound full of pain.
"We need to lift him," said Seth. "Get him off the spikes."
Chase looked at the man spread across the bamboo stakes.
"Should we?"
he started to say.
"Is it going to hurt him more to pull him off?"
"We can't leave him like this,"
snapped Seth.
"I mean, first aid. I think you're not supposed to pull things out of puncture wounds."
"We have to do something."
Iman moaned. It could have been a scream that didn't have enough strength behind it. More of his blood tapped out Morse code on the floor of the pit.
"We have to lift him off the stakes,"
Seth repeated. Easily a dozen thoughts and scenarios raced through Chase's mind. The amount of blood Iman would lose once all the stake wounds were open, the risk of infection, the odds of shock, the lack of medical supplies, their distance from any actual medical care. Out loud, he said,
"Okay,"
because what else could he say? They stretched forward. Chase set a cautious hand beneath Iman's arm right by the stake. Another one went next to the shaft, impaling his waist. Iman cried out as Chase's fingers pressed against his stomach. Seth reached beneath Iman. He locked eyes with Chase. They stared at each other.
"On three?"
"On three,"
agreed Chase.
"One, two, three,"
they said together. They lifted. Iman screamed and flailed as much as his pinned limbs allowed. Chase felt the meat of the man's arm drag across the bamboo stake. The one by Iman's waist resisted for a heartbeat and then slid out, prompting another scream. Iman struggled and shrieked, a desperate pattern of gasping air in and wailing it back out. His free leg kicked wildly up and down. His shoe struck down on the tip of another spike and ripped the side open to the sole. Chase got the arm free and it lashed out at him, at the stakes, at anything it could reach. He moved both his hands to Iman's torso and heaved. Across from him, Seth did the same, pressing up on the body with his arms wide, like a weightlifter. Iman rose up off the red slicked shafts and his screams became low, coughing cries. He choked, coughed again, and sprayed a handful of dark blood out of his mouth. Another burst of blood was pushed out by a low, primal wail. Seth shouted desperate words at the man. He shifted his attention to Chase.
"Lift!
I'm trying!"
Blood squished between his fingers as he crouched and pushed up with his legs. Raindrops of it burst on his cheeks. Iman came free of the spikes. Blood spat out of his wounds onto the ground. His chest heaved and twitched. He gagged and coughed out long red strings that ran down his chin. Chase's arms trembled as he and Seth shuffle-walked Iman over the grove of stakes to the edge of the pit. The third mate shook and pulled at their grip. His movements had slid past thrashing and toward a state Chase could only think of as convulsing.
"We need to stop the bleeding," he said. "We need bandages or tape or something."
"Back at the raft," said Seth. "There's a first aid kit in one of the packs."
They got Iman past the last of the wooden spikes and lowered him to the ground. His arms shook free of their hands, and he spit up another mouthful of blood. His eyelids fluttered, and he gargled a few words. And then he died. 11. Murdoch stayed on his feet while Anne crouched even lower, finally dropping to her knees in the sand. She grabbed at the strands of seaweed, the thick ribbons of kelp, and dragged them off the body, each handful more frantic, more desperate than the last. It took her less than a minute to expose most of it. She folded back the ragged edge of a damp leather cloak.